לתשומת ליבכם, התוכנית הבאה היא תוכנית מוקלטת, ועשויות להישמע במהלכה התראות והתייחסות לאירועים ביטחוניים שהראו בזמן שידורה הראשון. האזנה טובה.
שלום, כן. כן, לא שומע עכשיו. Good evening, this is Mark Weiss with a roundup of the top news stories at this hour on day 200 of the war against Hamas. The IDF has called on some residents of northern Gaza's Beit Lahia to evacuate to other areas of the town as the military launched a new operation in the area. Israel bombed a number of locations in northern Gaza on Tuesday after terrorists fired rockets at Sderot, the closest Israeli city to the Gaza border, setting a warehouse on fire. Israel said the strikes on northern Gaza targeted rocket launch sites. Some 60 projectiles have been launched from Gaza at southern Israel in the last 2 months, indicating that terrorist groups have maintained their fighting capacity despite the ongoing IDF operation. According to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry, more than 34,000 Palestinians have been killed since the war began. 1,200 people were killed and 253 hostages seized in the surprise Hamas attack on October the 7th. 133 hostages, dead and alive, remain in Hamas captivity. Tuesday marked the 200th day of the Gaza War, as Jews in Israel celebrated the start of the one-week holiday of Passover, Pesach, in a somber mood. Passover was ushered in on Monday night with the traditional Seder night meal. Many families this year placed an empty seat at the table to symbolize the 133 hostages who remain in Hamas captivity. At other Seder night gatherings, each participant was asked to adopt a hostage and say a few words about him or her. Many families of the hostages chose to forego the traditional meal altogether. Some 500 members of Kibbutz Be'eri, where 100 members were killed on October the 7th, held a collective Passover Seder in Tel Aviv's Hostage Square. The IDF spokesperson issued a statement Tuesday clarifying that the 200 bodies unearthed near the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis were bodies that had been exhumed by Israel and checked to make sure they were not the bodies of hostages before being reburied, showing respect for the dead. The statement followed comments on Tuesday by United Nations Rights Chief Volker Türk, saying he was horrified by the destruction of the Nasser and Al-Shifa hospitals in Gaza and reports of mass graves discovered there. Türk, addressing a United Nations briefing via a spokesperson, also criticized Israeli strikes on Gaza in recent days, which he said killed mostly women and children. He also repeated a warning against a full-scale Israeli invasion of the southern city of Rafah, where more than 1 million people fled as refugees from the war. The Hezbollah-affiliated Al-Mayadeen television station reported Tuesday that Hamas will not agree to another country replacing Qatar as a mediator for a new ceasefire and hostage release deal. Qatar, along with Egypt and the US, has played a key role in contacts between Israel and Hamas. But Doha recently raised the possibility of ending its role following pressure from Israel and the US, who urged more flexibility from Hamas amid the failure to achieve a breakthrough for a new truce. On the northern border, Israel says it killed two senior Hezbollah terrorists in separate strikes in South Lebanon today. A senior member of the Iranian-backed group's air defense unit and a senior member of its elite Radwan strike force. In response, Hezbollah launched drones striking deeper into Israeli territory, aiming towards Akko and close to Haifa. And sirens today sounded at various locations along the northern border, including at Baram and Margaliot. Protests over the war in Gaza have taken hold of a handful of elite U.S. universities as officials scramble to defuse the demonstrations. Police moved to break up an encampment at New York University on Monday night, making a number of arrests. Dozens of students were arrested at Yale earlier in the day, while Columbia University cancelled in-person classes. An Israeli professor who teaches at Columbia was denied access to the campus. Protests and heated debates about the Israel-Hamas war and free speech have rocked U.S. campuses since October the 7th. There has been a rise in anti-Semitic incidents since then. When asked about the rallies on Monday, President Biden said he condemned both the anti-Semitic protests as well as those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians. The protest movement was thrust into the spotlight last week after New York City police were called out to Columbia's campus and arrested more than 100 demonstrators. Rallies have since spread to New York University in Yale, the University of California at Berkeley, MIT, the University of Michigan, Emerson College, and Tufts. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi said today that an Israeli attack on Iranian territory would bring about a complete change of circumstances. Raisi was visiting Pakistan, was quoted as saying that such an attack could possibly result in there being nothing left of the Zionist regime. The New York Times reports that according to three Israeli officials, Israel cancelled a much more extensive retaliation attack on Iran after U.S. and other foreign allies pressured it to reconsider. According to the report, Israel had originally planned to strike several Iranian military targets, including near Tehran, in a manner that would have been harder for Iran to ignore. Israeli officials told the New York Times that Israel wanted to signal Iran that it developed the capacity to attack it without violating its airspace or even setting off its air defense systems. An independent review by the UN has found that Israel has not provided evidence for its claims that many UNRWA workers belong to terror organizations in the Gaza Strip. Israel's foreign ministry spokesperson responded that the report ignored the severity of the problem and offers cosmetic solutions that do not deal with the enormous scope of Hamas infiltration into UNRWA. That's the news. This is Mark Weiss from Jerusalem.
You're listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening and Chag Sameach. This is Nomi Segal with a program for the Passover holiday. In this special interview, Rabbi David Mason, a former community rabbi in London and the current executive director of the social action organization Hayas Jacor, speaks to London correspondent Jerry Lewis about the inward and outward aspects of Passover.
Rabbi David Mason, former communal rabbi, community rabbi in two parts of London, now got a new job. More about that later on. But first of all, Pesach this year, very, very significant because of what's been happening in the Middle East and the anti-Semitism we've seen around the world. Such some reflections from you on the significance of Pesach and how it ties in with what problems we have today.
Thanks, Jerry, so much for having me on. It's really good to be on for my first time here. Great to be with you. So, yeah, on Pesach, there is an inward side and an outward side to Pesach. The inward side, of course, is the suffering that the Jewish people went through in Egypt. And in some ways, we reflect on the fact that in every generation, there are struggles. In every generation, there are people that are out to get the Jewish people. But part of the Passover story is the belief that God is there, in a sense, to protect us from that. Hence, there is still a Jewish community today over so many generations. And so today, this year, we do think about 7th of October. It's very much in our mind. We think about those who won't be celebrating Pesach because they're in captivity and hostage. We think of our brethren, our brothers and sisters in the state of Israel, which is so important to us as a people, and how they will be feeling with the worry of attack from Iran. And of course, after the Hamas attack and the war going on in Gaza. So definitely there is a reflectiveness inward about we will sit together and we will be reflecting together on it being a difficult time for Jewish people at the moment. And that adds here, of course, outside Israel. I don't think it's as difficult, clearly, but it is tricky, it is difficult. We've seen a growth in anti-Semitism, and we're that bit more worried about being Jewish.
The Passover service consists of, famously, of a meal, but prayers both before and after. Can you give us some ideas of the types of prayers which we have to say?
Yeah, so we have a Seder, and the Seder is an order, and in fact the meal in some ways is part of that order. So rather than it being prayers, the central thing about Passover is to tell the story of something that happened a long time ago. We are on Passover as a nation, each in our own way, using the Haggadah as a tool to tell the story of the foundation of our nation. And that's big, isn't it, in terms of our identity, that we all on Passover, however religious we are, whichever denomination we are, will in some way connect back to that foundation story of our people. And we do that through a number of readings connected to the Bible. There's lots of layers to the Passover Seder. And we, in a sense, there is a pattern which starts in slavery and ends in freedom. On the night of Passover, through what we do, through the eating of the matzah, the leavened bread, through eating the maror, even the charoset, these are symbols that can both be understood as symbols of slavery, but also symbols of freedom. That's really the sort of trajectory of the Passover night, which ends with Hallel singing praises on our freedom, and of course the songs we love singing at the end as well.
There are many traditions associated with Pesach, Passover, not least of all the Afikoman. What's the significance, especially of the Afikoman, besides for kids?
Yes, exactly. It's always been a kids thing, and no one really knows what the Afikoman is. The Afikoman, in a way, the second bit of matzah that we eat later as dessert, is meant to represent actually the Passover offering. It's meant to be in place of that. We don't do offerings, we don't have offerings, but in the days of Temple, the Passover offering, obviously, was, from a biblical perspective, really important and central part. And so it was instituted that instead of that, the Passover offering would be eaten actually as dessert, unbelievably. There was a lot of meat eaten in those days. We eat instead of that, we eat the Afikoman. So it also represents a sense of freedom. And it's the last taste we're meant to have. So even though many would say you don't want matzah to be your last taste, I suppose it's having the taste of freedom on your mouth, which is really important at the Seder. The last drink is meant to be from the four cups of wine, which is also a taste of freedom.
And why four cups?
So four is a big number, yeah. Four is a cracking number, really. And we are, we read in the Bible, reading the Torah, early in the book of Exodus, that there are four languages used for redemption. I will take you out, I will save you, I will redeem you, and I will take you to me as a people. God speaks redemption in four different ways. And the rabbis thought, okay, these are four different levels of freedom, from taking you out of the slavery to saving you to redeeming you from that place, and to then building a relationship around the Torah, according to the religious approach. It's interesting that there is a fifth word there. I will bring you to Israel. And there are opinions, would you believe it, in halakha, in Jewish law, that there is a fifth cup of wine. There is an opinion of a fifth cup of wine.
But is that Elijah's cup?
Well, exactly. Isn't it interesting that because there is an argument as to whether we should drink a fifth cup of wine, there is this idea that Elijah comes to solve all problems. And that, for many, is why it's called Elijah's cup. Because whenever the messianic period comes, or Elijah will come, the idea is that he will decide whether it should be or not, which I quite like. I think that's quite cute.
But Jews don't normally drink excessively, maybe a Purim, Simchat Torah, but...
No, and it's very interesting. I think there was a famous rabbi who would have a very quick Seder, have the four cups, go for a shluf, a little sleep, and then come and do the Seder because he felt there was too much wine because he was the rabbi and he has to decide. So you're right. I suppose they're spread, but it's a good point. It's not, I suppose, excessive because you're meant to drink a certain amount and you don't have to go a lot more than that. Some will mix with grape juice. And if they can't tolerate wine, then you can still fulfill it through drinking grape juice. There is just an element of freedom associated with red wine. And red is because, I suppose, of the plague of blood, which is part of the story. So.
I've attended a few seders with friends who are very dutty from Orthodox, where they have to eat a certain amount of matzah to comply with what rules there were. Yeah. I found it a struggle. Where's the origins of that?
So the origins are in terms of how we understand the measurements. So really, what is an olives amount? And because of rabbis over history changing the measurements and developing it, it's not like the olive that you see. Some say that, actually. And therefore, it's basically the complicated nature of measurements in Jewish law. And for some, there was a rabbi in B'nai Brak in the middle of the 20th century called the Chazon Ish, who doubled the measurements, and it ends up being a lot more, which will add also to the amount of wine you're meant to drink, and etc. So it is a lot. And then I suppose we get very worried on Pesach about making sure we fulfill, and therefore you're like, okay, I'll go for the strict one, because whatever happens, that's going to be the right one. And so, yeah, you're right, people end up stuffing their face with matzah on Pesach, and then they don't want to eat it anymore, I suppose.
There's also the Paschal lamb. What's the relevance of Paschal lamb? Is it part of the offering of the altar? Or
yeah, the Paschal lamb, you know, for many offerings are difficult, aren't they? But the Paschal lamb was in temple times the central service and part of it. Obviously this goes back to that moment of redemption for the Jewish people it represents. So we don't do everything that was done on that night when they came out of Egypt. In fact, actually, there are lots of things, like they were told to put their belts on and get ready and put their backpacks on their back. We don't do that. There is, interestingly, a custom I saw where people put buckets of water on the floor, put a backpack with matzah and go through it, just like they went through the Red Sea. And the Sephardi Jews also have some really interesting customs as well like that. So it's all really about, as much as we can, trying to reenact the Exodus. We can't fully do it. We weren't there. There is a belief that many have that our souls were there, the Jewish people were there in some sort of way. But we can't fully do it, but we do as much as we can.
Well, I've been to a Sephardi Seder on a few occasions where a spring onion is produced, and during Dayenu, people go round and hit each other.
I can't remember why that is. There is a good reason for that, but that is great fun. I know. I remember someone, well, yeah, there was a member of my synagogue who used to talk about doing that when he was younger, yeah.
And, of course, we have a boiled egg.
Yeah.
And that comes from?
Well, the boiled egg's interesting, actually, because there is this idea, it's actually real, that the first day of Passover is always the same day of the week as the 9th of Av. And the 9th of Av is a day of mourning, which is interesting. You've got this element of mourning. And think about, actually, what that means for us as people who are mourning what happened on the 7th of October and what we've been hearing since. So probably the egg could take on a lot more resonance for us now. The idea that it's round, which is cycle of life, but the egg is a mourning food. It's a food that's first given to people who sit Shiva, who mourn after losing a close relative. And so it connects between the mourning of Tisha B'Av and Pesach, because they're on the same day. That's how it got in, which is really interesting.
Now, for those listeners who are in Israel, they just have one night of Seder. For us, Chutz La'aretz, abroad, diaspora Jews, we have two. Is there any way around all that?
No, I don't think so. I think, well, we need a strong Sanhedrin and a return of some sort of glory to the, or more unity maybe around the religious life of Israel. So I don't think yet we're anywhere near that. The biggest issue, of course, is for Jews who go to Israel, who are from here. and there are different opinions there. Some will be right, I will do like the place I'm in. And there was a rabbi called the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Ashkenazi, who said that. You do according to the custom. And some say, you know, sorry, it's about where you, you know, it's the stricter approach. So you'll get different approaches. And it's always about who you ask, you know. You ask Lubavitch, Lubavitch will say do one day in Israel. If you live in London or in outside Israel, they will say, when you're in Israel for Pesach, do one day. So always ask a Lubavitch if you want the right answer for that one.
In the British community, there's been a recommendation to commemorate, to remember the hostages. What are we supposed to be doing?
So we've been, we have the idea, haven't we, of a separate seat, an empty seat for a hostage. And I think that's right. I think, you know, we have a cup for Elijah, don't we? There's something about people coming in. In fact, we at the beginning, actually, of our Haseder say, Kol dichvin yete v'yechol, all who are hungry, come and eat. So there is something about those not here. I know people who do a fifth son, talk about the son that, for someone who's special needs. And so there is that. So I think it is very appropriate this year that we do that, that we it allows us to reflect on what we've lost at our Seder.
Now, you've come out of being a rabbi for a community. You still retain your title, obviously. You've taken on a fascinating new job within the community involving the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. We need a little explanation of what they do. And J-Corps, which is looking after refugees, etc. Can you give us some insight onto the work which this will involve?
Absolutely. I think it also connects back to I talked about the inside bit of Passover. There's the outward-looking bit, isn't there, which is all who are hungry, right? This is the bread. All who are hungry. All is very open. And so even at the same time as we're going to be thinking about ourselves and we worry about anti-Semitism and about the threats to Israel, it's important that, for me, it's important that the Jewish community still realises its important place and responsibility within society. I think the chief rabbi mentions that well. One of his planks was responsibility. And so that's really led me to move on from the rabbinate after a good, positive 20 years of being a rabbi of a community to running Hayas J-Corps. And our main aim is to be a Jewish organisation that supports refugees. We want to advocate within the sector. So we want to be able to help with policy change, help talk to members of parliament, to politicians, city hall, councillors. So we want to be there doing that work. We want to engage with the Jewish community.
So it's outreach, basically.
Yes, exactly, outreach, but both out in the sector, in the political world, but also within the community. So we're already building quite a lot of relationships with Jewish communities. And we are able to inform them, inspire them, and also work on developing volunteer projects so that members of Jewish communities can befriend, support refugees, and also or hold events in their community about issues around refugees. And also, in terms of taking on the legacy of J-Corps, the anti-racism side, thinking about the racism that refugees often face. People who come here from other places who need our support often find that it's very difficult because, in some way, because of racism. And we want to be at the forefront of allowing our community to stand against that when it can.
And this is not for Jews, this is to help.
Our beneficiaries are not Jewish. Yeah, listen, if a refugee is Jewish, we're not turning them away. But generally today, Hayas, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, is over 100 years old. It was based in America, but now is global, 22 countries, supports in a humanitarian way refugees, people who are displaced. So in Chad, there are hundreds of thousands of Sudanese there. In Kenya, they work with Somali. In Colombia, Guatemala, in Europe with Ukrainians. And their idea, Hayas, is that we were helping Jews, so they would help Jews from the Holocaust, pogroms, Soviet Union. But now, as Jews, we're helping others. It's our Jewish values of compassion, of a desire for partnership, of solidarity, that mean that we want to help others as well. And I think that's what we're taking on here, to be that organisation that's our focus, to try and, in a sense, motivate, mobilise Jewish people, community, to help people who need us.
So we're helping other members of other religions as well. You're known for being very positive towards interfaith.
Yeah, and I think that's a part of it. And I think one of the things that we are looking at is where possible to combine with other faiths. So I've actually been building a group of faith leaders to amplify our voice on refugees.
And these are from other faiths?
From Church of England, Methodism, from the Muslim community. And I think it's also a way where, even given the difficulties we face at the moment, and we always need to be, I think, sensible, we always need to be careful, because of the context of Israel, and understanding anti-Semitism, so we always have to be careful who we work with. But I think within that, the refugee crisis that we are seeing allows us to build those partnerships.
Now, refugees is a word which is very emotive. We were, if you can call it, refugees from Egypt. Yeah. Today, there are refugees pouring into Britain through from Britain, Africa and the Middle East. America has lots of refugees coming in from Mexico, etc., etc. What's the lesson for Pesach to deal with refugees?
Well, we are told in the Bible and the Torah, you should love the stranger because you were strangers in Egypt. When we were strangers in Egypt, it meant we were treated in a way where we had zero compassion. We had our place. I don't think we were pouring in. And I don't think actually even today the numbers are pouring into our country. Often these politicians make it look like that. But I don't think in terms of the numbers of asylum seekers, if you look at the percentage of the refugees in the past that we had in this country and the general world problem, we're not being flooded with people. You know, there are 100 million or so people in the world who are refugee. Most of them are either internally displaced or in the neighbouring country. So it's a very smaller amount who move. And many have reasons to move because they might have family or because they think Britain's a good place to be. And whatever we do, it probably is a lot better than where they've come from. So for me, we had that lack of compassion. Therefore, if we have people in that situation, we should treat them with compassion too. I accept that every country has borders, and that means that you need security and you need some element of control. I do accept that. So this is not an open border policy, but we don't have an open border. I don't think any party is suggesting that. And I think what we need to do is have a system which is fair, treats people properly, and allows the best chance, like we had, to become neighbours. We want to turn the stranger, because we were, into neighbours, people who take their bin out, send their kids to school, contribute to the economy and contribute to society. From our experience, that wasn't always easy, but I think we can do that for others.
Only a larger number of Jews flooded into Britain in between the war to World War One and World War Two. Others came even earlier waves of immigration. And they settled in without the problems that modern immigrants have.
And if you remember, I'm not saying if you remember because both of us don't remember, but there was opposition. You know, in the early 20th century with the alien law, right, there was opposition. So it also, you know, we suffered that sense of there's too many invading. Well, I don't think the numbers, I mean, we know from Kinder Transport was, 10,000? So we were, you know, others obviously came, but, and there was a serious need then because those turned away would be killed. You know, we really had a serious need. So, yeah.
The concept of looking after refugees is in most people's inner feelings, even to welcome a stranger at the table for Pesach. There is a strong view in certain Jewish circles that there's too many immigrants coming in, both in America, they feel it, and there's a vociferous groups in America, and even here in Britain, where there are some people who say, Dayenu, enough.
I think the reason that people might feel that is because of the way the system has been worked. If it was done properly, if people's claims were seen quickly, if they were then allowed a chance, if housing stock was better, health outcomes were better, whatever, I think that we would less feel the problem. We are a country of immigration. I mean, if you look, that's, you know, going back to, you know, Indian, Pakistani, Windrush. We are, in a sense, layers of immigration. And people who become part of this country and who want to, in their way, feel British. And so I think if we have a system, and I want a government to do that, which is which allows the asylum claim, which treats it fairly, and so yes, some might have to return, that's fine, which allows good outcomes for people, which works with councils, which works with civil society, we would, I think, we would feel it less. In other ways, we need a better social contract in this country. And at the moment, I feel there's more division than togetherness. I think that togetherness would probably allay a lot of fears.
Do you have many fellow travellers amongst your rabbinical colleagues?
I think, listen, I'm now working, in a sense, in this position across the community. So across the denominations, there are quite a few rabbis and leaders who agree with this. And I think it's also a function of how much time people will put into Israel. And at the moment, that's a big issue for many people. And so there might be less bandwidth for this. But I think if you find the right project, program, idea, I think this is less controversial than people actually feel. If this means befriending someone locally, building a group of people in the community who can support a local family, it could be telephoning, it could be collection, it could be having events. There are ways in which a community can do something which I think are all right, and we can work with them. And we want to be an organisation that works with local communities to help them.
And the organisation has supported those Jewish families who've taken in Ukrainian refugees.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't worked directly with them. So that's, and World Jewish Relief have been doing some work on that and do great work, obviously. But we, obviously, I think that's amazing. And that's been the reaction of the community to that has been incredible. There are difficulties with that program because it was 6 months. For some, they've kept going. For others, it's giving difficulty for the Ukrainian who then has nowhere to go.
But that's a government decision to make it six months. Just to come draw this to a conclusion, there are two areas I wanted to ask you about. There are some Jews going around the community saying, we're not very happy with Israel and what's happening in Israel at the moment. It's not that we're not in favour of Israel defending itself, but some are maintaining the way it's doing it is causing waves and anti-Semitism. What message have you got for them?
I think that's not our area of work. I think what we would say is, clearly that there are certain things above the politics. I think for us, it's important that there is a state of Israel, which is inclusive, democratic. It's important for us that there is a Palestinian state, or there should be a Palestinian state. And I think with that, we would want an end to the conflict through a political process. And I think for us as a humanitarian organisation as well, we definitely worry about the humanitarian situation in Gaza. So I'm not looking at our organisation to be a political organisation in terms of political Zionism that's situated somewhere. There are other organisations that can do that. I think we do still need to accept that the state of Israel is very important for the Jewish community, for Jewish identity. It's incontrovertible that that's the case. But I do think that there will be more and more people who will find criticism. And I think there will be fault lines also between Israel and the diaspora. So if you don't mind me saying, one of the things that I found difficult today, I think, was the giving of an award by the president of Israel to Douglas Murray. And I think personally, and we would find him someone who, yes, might be very pro-Israel and pro-Jewish, but at the same time is quite extreme in his relationship with Islam. And it's problematic with that. And that just creates a sort of a shaking of the relationship, which I think we need to think about as a community.
And the final question, not unrelated to the Douglas Murray, things have changed drastically since the 7th of October for people who are working in the interfaith field, trying to bring together Muslims and Jews. Has it affected your work? What do you advise communities to do?
I think when I was a rabbi, I set up the multi-faith network in Haringey. And one of the key elements to it was that it was a very much strong part of civic society, that we were bringing faith leaders together in order to create social cohesion. So I think there's certainly a lesson for interfaith. If interfaith is simply about interfaith conversation, then my worry is it won't go deep. But if interfaith relationship is about building social cohesion, however bumpy, right, and it could be that it's private and not public sometimes, it will be conflict resolution based sometimes, it could be open and robust, showing where offence is, where the lines should be, then I think we all should be hopeful that there will be communities that can build relationships to each other. And so maybe we should look a little bit beyond interfaith to the world of social cohesion.
You studied conflict resolution.
I studied it in King's College, Conflict Resolution in Divine Society. My members of my synod used to say, oh, wow, you'll be great at conflict. And I used to say, well, I'll help with Rwanda, maybe. I'm not sure with the shul, which I was joking. But
there's the same balance Israel between different sectors of the Jewish community with each other and also with the Palestinians.
I think we're going to extremes. I think what's happened, I mean, Hamas are very clever, aren't they? And this is probably what they wanted, is that it pushes people to the extremes. It's like, in some ways, I would say that what happened on the 7th of October was our 9/11. I'm not sure about the Holocaust. I mean, obviously, it was the largest number, but I wouldn't compare it to the Holocaust, simply because we have a state. We didn't then. We could, you know, and we made big mistakes to allow it ourselves in neglecting the border, but we could just shore up the border and we now go in, right? But I would say it's our 9/11. And that has obviously big effects, you know, on the state, you know. So, yeah.
Well, it's been a fascinating discourse. And Rabbi David Mason, I'm very, very grateful to you.
Jerry.
And can I wish you hatzlacha?
Thank you very much.
Chag Sameach.
Have a lovely chag, and it's been great being on. Thank you, Jerry.
Rabbi David Mason. Passover is a time of helping those in need. The ongoing war in Gaza has exacerbated food insecurity in Israel for a number of reasons. Since the outbreak of the war, the food rescue organization Lekkit Israel, the National Food Bank, has worked not only to provide food to the vulnerable, but also to support hard-hit farmers. Ahead of the holiday, we spoke with Lekkit Israel founder and chairman, Joseph Gittler. Can you give us a snapshot of food insecurity in Israel from the different components at this time?
Yeah, sure. And thank you for having me on. Look, I think we're now 6 months since the war started. So I would say things have started to normalize a little bit, meaning outside of the north and the hardest hit areas next to the Gaza border, a lot of people have moved back to their homes, which means for the Lekkits of the world to work with local partners, a lot of those local partners are now back in business, and so we can serve food through them again, whereas over the past few months, we've had to hustle to serve the poor where they are because certainly their situation did not improve because of the war. Another major difference, just to add for Lekkit, is our normal activities, which is rescuing excess crops and excess cooked meals, went almost to zero in the weeks and months after October 7th. And while not completely back to normal, we're still purchasing a hefty amount of fruits and vegetables. A lot of our normal rescue activities have returned. So a little bit of normalization for the time being, which is good, especially now when there's always so much increased demand around Passover.
The war has also impacted farmers themselves. Certainly, they were having a lot of difficulty working the fields. There has also been a return to that in some areas, including in the Gaza periphery. Has Lekkit been part of those efforts with volunteers coming and helping out?
Sure. We've been super involved. We've placed 80,000 volunteers since October 7th, primarily working in the south. More than that, we've paid for over 2,000 buses since October 7th, whenever it's been safe. Now there's no more of a permission from the Army, at least over the last couple of months. But we've worked closely hand-in-hand with the farmers and the Army to get volunteers down there. We've provided debit cards to farmers who've been hard hit. And now we just started a large program together with Strauss Elite, where we'll be providing millions of dollars in grants to hard-hit farmers who need to buy, let's say, a new pickup truck. Their truck was damaged by rocket fire, or they don't have the money to buy seeds. So we're really doing everything to help farmers where normally, really, frankly, farmers just help Leket by giving us their excess crops. It's been a 180-degree turn, with the biggest and most important piece being that we've bought tens of millions of pounds of fruits and vegetables that farmers were having trouble selling just because of temporary changes in the market. You know, no tourism, and if you sell to the hotel trade, you might have gotten crops stuck that you couldn't sell. Leket came to the rescue for many farmers.
That connects to my next question. From your perspective and connections with this sector, how were they impacted? You mentioned some of the points. What about simply the harvesting of the crops? This is from a perspective of harvest waste.
Oh, my God. Okay, so you have things that were never harvested, waste, and that was primarily for security reasons. Let's take the entire north, where essentially farming has been put on hold since October 7th. In the south, there was short-term damage in that sense that you couldn't harvest. A lot of that has been fixed by now. The bigger, longer-term issue in the south was fields that were damaged by rocket fire and then fields that were damaged by military, like my son in his tank, driving his tank over fields. And so now that's a big job for farmers and the government to rehabilitate those fields. And you're talking about tens of thousands of dunams that were damaged. And that's an impact on our food security, food pricing, imports, and we can go down the line. It's just the repercussions are massive.
So where do you see, where does Leket see the most acute needs? And what can be done or what should be done about them?
Okay, so look, I think the most acute need is going to be with farmers on the northern border, where basically they've been knocked out of work completely. That's simply going to, they're just going to need money to survive. And I'll say more than that. We need to be able to convince farmers in the north and farmers who've been hard hit elsewhere that we care about them, that we love them, that we want them to continue farming, which is often a difficult business because the state of Israel, as we know, stands always in a very tricky place, the history of the Jewish people. We need to have our own food supply. And so private individuals, the government, amutot, need to come together to make sure that farmers feel that if they get back into this, once things calm down, that they're not going to be let down and have financial issues. So that could be cash transfers. That could be interest-free loans. Government support, maybe canceling debt, all that kind of stuff we need because our food security issues in this country are different, sadly, I would say, than many other countries in the world.
And that's from a policy perspective. From an individual's perspective, what can people do to help?
Okay, so I think one great way to help, besides volunteering when we come, we need endless volunteers still in the South primarily. Leket is and will continue to raise funds for this farmer grant program. And I think that is a great use of stuck up charitable dollars now, because that money will go to help keep farmers on their feet, either by buying their excess crops that they can't sell or by helping them buy products that they need or vehicles or tractors, because we need to show them the love and keep them in business for our own sake, frankly.
And what about families? How acute is the need during these times?
So look, I think happily our unemployment continues to remain relatively low. Most people are working. Wages have stayed pretty consistent, which is good. But food prices, and this is really the bummer in Israel, food prices here were always more expensive than the rest of the OECD, and they've become more so since the war started and oil prices have gone up and countries haven't been selling to us. And so it's made food specifically more difficult for those that even a few percent change in price has a big impact on. So there's a lot of need, a lot of demand, and we're going to push very hard. We have less than a week till Passover. We're going to do whatever we can to get as much food into the system. And of course, I invite your listeners to help us do that.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Naomi. Happy and hopefully quiet holidays to everyone.
Leket Israel founder and chairman, Joseph Gittler. Finally, the 6 months since the October 7th massacre by Hamas have seen a huge increase in people seeking help for trauma. One of the organizations offering support is Natal, the Israeli Trauma and Resiliency Center. reporter Arieh O'Sullivan spoke with Yifat Morad, head of international relations and development at Natal, about the organization's work.
Natal is a 26 years old organization. It's an NGO, a totally apolitical organization that was established to give an answer for all those who suffer from symptoms or from PTSD, what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. due to terror and war and horrible events. For the past 26 years, we've been always there in an emergency event and taking care of the people during the emergency, but also many, many days, months, and years after the event. When the event started on the 7th of October mm-hmm. and the war, we were there as usual. We thought it started with missile attacks. So immediately our helpline, which always ready 24/7, with two volunteers, very sleepy volunteers, on a Shabbat morning, yes. or holiday, a very, very relaxed day. And we understood that there is a missile attack. So immediately we call upon a few more volunteers and open and switch to what we call emergency mode, which means that they put the helpline number on television, on all the main channels, and we have more volunteers answering the line.
We've been into the war now 6 months. And who are the? How can you give us the makeup of the people who are coming to get services with you?
Right now we are dealing with, I think we can say, three big groups of people who turn to Natal. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are the people who were living in the area in the south. We're talking about the festivals, you know, Nova Festival, and the parties that were going on over there. And we're talking about the people who were displaced. And right now we're talking also about the veterans coming back from a deployment mm-hmm. and facing the hardship of going back to routine when the next summon to come back to duty and come back to the military is in the horizon.
Really?
So we are talking about right now with a lot of thousands of people. All of them are citizens, but from different kind of origin that went through the hardship of this war.
Today in the Knesset, there was some testimony from people who were survivors of the Nova, and they said yeah. something very interesting. They said that there's been a large number of people who were survivors who committed suicide, over 50 people. Are you seeing that?
Yeah. So you saw the Nova Festival, you know, there were more than 4,000 people at that festival. And what they had to go through is the worst thing ever. Mm-hmm. There are many, many people who are helping right now to the Nova Festival survivors. One of them is Natal. So Natal was nominated by a group of, you know, government of some offices of the government and Mifala Pais and other organization to come and give a service that they give a few kind of services. One is giving therapy. Another one is giving all kind of intervention like yoga, like art therapy, all kind of things that they can get. Yes, mm-hmm. we understand that they, you know, the more you get the more you get into the past days and the passing months.
Yes.
And not bringing back the hostage, the burden on the mental burden on the survivor is very, very heavy. I never received the data that you're talking about from the official. We are treating at the moment more than 600 people from the Nova wow. Festival. And we hope, and we do hope, and I'm saying that whoever needs help and needs to speak to somebody and needs to give one-on-one therapy, he should seek it. We are in a race now to reach as many people as we can. And not only Natal, by the way. Natal is not doing it alone. There are right. many, many organizations that give this assistance. It's really crucial to be there for those people as fast as possible.
Now, I want to ask you about the veterans. Yeah. You know, Israel's 75 years old, 76 years old, and we've gone through lots of wars, and maybe PTSD wasn't aware in previous generations, but it seems that this group of veterans particularly have a high number of people who are seeking help.
Yes, well, we're talking now about a very different generation. We, you know, Natal was established because of the Yom Kippur War, which mm-hmm. was a horrible event in the life of Israeli state. But back then, you know, they try to hide the post-trauma and not talk about it.
Right.
If people turned with symptoms like a nightmare, couldn't go back to work, had problems with in the relationship, in the family, and all kinds of symptoms that they suffered, they told them, you know, go to rest, come back, you'll be fine. Nobody gave it a room. But now it's a different time, you know. Right now, there is a different generation that wants to speak about things. They understand trauma. Mm-hmm. They understand what they need to do, and they're reaching much faster to seek help, and still the shame and the withdrawal and the hiding is still there. And that's what Natalia is, why we are putting a lot of effort to raise awareness, not only for the people who went through it, but also to all their family, the spouses, their children, their parents. They need to be very alert with the symptoms. And that's why it's so important to reach out and get help, either for the helpline or afterwards with different kind of activities, and not, you know, to Natal or other places. The faster you reach and you get help, the better chance that you will not develop.
But I want to ask you about the payment. How does, is this a free service? Is it subsidized?
So since Natal is an NGO, and we are most of the budget of Natal is until the 7th of October was more than 70% from donation. So yes, most of the services of Natal is totally free. People who reach out and get the help through the helpline don't pay anything. If they get to therapy, they pay a commitment fee of something like 30 shekels, and those who cannot pay it do not pay that also. So, you know, it's most of the services of Natal is totally free. They just need to seek help, and they will get it.
That's fantastic. It seems that you're getting a good look at the slice of Israel that reveals just how sensitive we are. Are we in a national survival mode?
We are in a national survival mode right now. We are a state that need to, we are still on the survival mode, but we also getting into what we call a surviving routine. Now, to be alert all the time, that takes a very heavy toll of all of us. And there is very, very, it's crucial that people will treat themselves, help themselves, and also try to get to some kind of routine. So when we'll get to the next stage of going back to work, bringing up our families, we'll have, you know, our children, a generation that seeks hope, that want to have peace, and still see things in an optimistic way. Yeah, we need, it's a nation that needs treatment. It's a nation that needs to do a lot of intervention. Not necessarily, you know, clinical treatment, but definitely need to be aware to help ourselves emotionally.
Is the fact that Israel's prepared for treating citizens with organizations like Natal a sign of resilience? And how would you compare it with the other countries?
Well, we just went through a miracle event, a shocking event, whatever you call it. This Saturday night.
Right.
I mean, thousands of missiles were, you know, launched by from Iran. And if you're looking at the people, you know, after going through a very dramatic night, they went in the morning. They woke up in the morning. Most of the people went back to their routine. They, you know, treat their children. They went back to work. Everybody went back to shop. People are doing what they are used to do, and this is resiliency. This is a very, and this is something that you invest in for many, many years. But still, the toll is there: the aggression, the high alert, the depression. Okay, all the things that we see around, it comes with a heavy toll. Yes, we are resilient, but we need to work on it. It's not something that you do from one day to another. It's something that you invest in it for years. We always say in Natal that we work around the clock in three times mode. We help during emergency, we help after something happened, but 50% of our time we prepare communities to what's going to come. The more you know about what's going to come, the better you act when it's coming. And I don't think most of the states around us are doing that. We had to do that because it's a necessity. We are going from one cycle to another. So we are used to prepare. If we know that when people go through some kind of, you know, sirens or an attack, they go through the three F's, you know, fight, fly, or freeze, they know how they act and they know how to work on it. So if they won't freeze, that when there is a siren, and they won't, and they will go immediately to help themselves. But this is something that you need to educate the people from childhood, from kindergarten, from schools, from the family, the military. You need to do it with everyone. So, yes, I think a lot of states need to go through it. And this is something that we share, by the way.
Oh, really?
With a lot of communities in the world, yes. Mm. With our friends in Germany, in England, in the States.
Interesting.
Unfortunately, we have to.
That's fantastic. Can you finally just maybe give us some details if someone wants to get in touch with Natal, how they can find it?
So, yes, I think the best thing is to call our helpline, which is the toll-free helpline. And from there, it's just the open gate for lots of services. So it's 1-800-363-363.
Okay. Thanks so much for talking to Khan English.
Thank you, and take care,
okay. All of you. Yifat Morad of Natal. That concludes our program. Thanks for listening. You can find Khan English on the Khan radio and digital platforms. This is Nomi Segal wishing you good evening and Chag Sameach. Here's Shlomo Artzi, Yareach, Moon.
וזיכרוני הראשון, אם יופייך אינו מטעה אותי, משליך גיטרה ואבי עליי צורח. ואימי אומרת זה, אחותה שלי, ולוקחת אותי לטיול מנחם מול ירח. וזיכרוני השני, עם עינייך אינן מטעות אותי, עוזב את הבית אל סיכוני הזמן. כששאלתי אותך האם תהי לי לעולמים, ענית תביט לירח, שם יש כבר אדם. ואחרי שנה שכרנו חדר מול ירח, מתחיל לנגן בבר קודר ברחוב המזכר. והם צרכו תורידו את הנמוך עם הטוקסידו, ורק אחד אמר ילד ילד או תוריד את הירח בשבילה. הייתה תקופה כזו כשהאושר בא בזר, צחקנו מהכל, שרפנו את מה שבא ליד, לא נשאר לנו אלא לחבק את הצער, להגיד אתמול היה טוב ויהיה גם מחר. אתמול היה טוב, אתמול היה טוב, אתמול היה טוב ויהיה גם מחר. אתמול היה טוב, אתמול היה טוב, אתמול היה טוב ויהיה גם מחר. קשה לי להתרכז כי יופייך עוד מהמם אותי, קשה להגיד חבל או לומר אולי. במקום זה אני רוקד וצועק לירח ומאשים את העולם מחבל. לפעמים אני שוכח איך התחלתי מול ירח, כשאתה שוכח, כן, כן, אתה מסכן. יש גשם בשמיים אל ירח בינתיים, וכשיצא נלך ביחד עד שנעלם. הייתה תקופה כזו כשהאושר בא בזר, צחקנו מהכל, שרפנו את מה שבא ליד, לא נשאר לנו אלא לחבר רצה להגיד אתמול היה טוב ויהיה גם מחר אתמול היה טוב אתמול היה טוב אתמול היה טוב ויהיה גם מחר אתמול היה טוב אתמול היה טוב אתמול היה טוב ויהיה גם מחר